It's time for the Burt Cohen Show. Dream. America. A lot of it is about money. People surviving, governments doing what they can to keep the economy strong. Well, the Federal Reserve Bank, also known as the Fed, is doing something that's kind of curious. It's gotten lost in a lot of recent news, but the Federal Reserve Bank is letting loose a whole bunch of paper money. What does this all mean? Is this good for the economy? Is it really bad for the economy? How is it going to affect Americans and North America, for that matter? Our guest today on the Burt Cohen Show is Rod Tremblay, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Montreal, and he's author of the book, The Code for Global Ethics. Professor Tremblay, thanks so much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show. What exactly has the Federal Reserve Bank done? What is their plan?
Hello, Mr. Cohen. I'm very happy to talk to you. Well, the Federal Reserve, as the U.S. Government, is facing sort of a perfect economic storm, at least since 2007. And they are trying to stimulate the U.S. economy. The only problem is to know if it is the right approach. In 2008 and 2009, when the crisis was at its apex, they printed a lot of money, $1.75 trillion of new money. They bought subprime securities, treasury securities, and all that. And now they have announced on November the 3rd, one day after the midterm election, that the Fed, Mr. Bernanke in charge, will like to add some $600 billion of new money. And I wrote a blog about that, and I think that you read it.
Yes.
And I think this is not necessarily the right approach, considering the types of problems that the U.S. economy is facing nowadays.
And $600 billion of new money. Now, that doesn't, it's not like there's $600 billion more reserve in Fort Knox. The amount of actual gold, the amount of actual value, I would think, remains the same. But is it the case that they're just printing $600 billion of paper money? What is...
Yes, since August 15, 1971... under the Nixon administration, the U.S. dollar is purely a fiat, what we call a fiat currency. It is not backed up by gold or other hard assets. Of course, it is backed up by the productivity of the U.S. economy, which is a very strong economy, the strongest in the world. But it is purely a currency based on confidence. If people believe that the value of that currency will hold its size, then people buy it. If not, they may go to buy other
currencies. Sure.
And that could be the problem that the U.S. may be facing in the coming years if that the monetary policy that Mr. Bernanke has announced, I'm sure with Mr. Obama's agreement, if this is done for too long, that may have negative implications. It may bring future inflation, higher interest rates, and not much more economic growth.
So we are talking with Rod Tremblay, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Montreal. So they're printing a lot more dollars. And, well, maybe we could back up just a little bit and say, who is this Bernanke? What philosophy does he bring to the economy?
Well, Mr. Bernanke has taken over Mr. Greenspan just before the crisis unfolded. And he believes, as Mr. Obama, I think, that printing money is a way to stimulate an economy. Of course, for Mr. Obama, he may have the feeling that the Congress is pretty much gridlock regarding any future stimulus to the economy, and that the Fed may take the leadership in stimulating the economy. But a central bank can always create inflation. There's no problem with that. You go to Zimbabwe, for example, where they have an hyperinflation. Underdeveloped countries have been doing that for many years. Sometimes they print too much money and there's very high inflation.
Yes.
The problem is to know if printing money can stimulate spending, real spending, and real economic growth and real jobs. And from my point of view and from other economists' point of view, this is a dream world. I don't think that the central bank has that power to create wealth just by printing money.
And this debate has been going on, oh my goodness, for at least 125 years or so. There was the whole debate in the 1890s with William Jennings Bryan, and prior to that, even the farmers, the people who were had borrowed money, the debtors, wanted more actual dollars available. And so this struggle has been going on for quite some time. So printing more dollars, more dollar bills, in a perfect world, what are the stated goals? What are the reasoning behind that? What do they hope to accomplish by flooding the market with $700 billion of new pieces of paper?
Well, if there were not enough money in circulation, of course, the central bank can provide liquidity, what it's called liquidity,
yes,
in the short run. But if you look at the situation today in the U.S., first, the largest banks have about $1 trillion of excess dormant excess reserves at the Fed, on which they receive a small interest. Corporations also have about $1 trillion of cash on which they sit, and they are not investing that money. And they, even the other banks have something like a trillion, a little bit more than a trillion of and a half of securities, treasury securities.
Uh-huh.
So there's a lot of money in circulation nowadays. So there's no lack of money. As a matter of fact, we may think that we are in what we call a liquidity trap. Means interest rates are as low as they could go when they are, at least the monetary rates, at 0%. Therefore, the main goal of the Fed, and that's what's creating a lot of tension at the meeting in Seoul of the G20 meeting at Seoul, is that the Fed wants to lower the U.S. dollar, to depreciate the U.S. dollar, in order to stimulate American exports. And that, of course, means that other currencies have to appreciate, and that's the big tension that exists now in international monetary affairs.
So then would it be the case that by, tell me if I have this right, by lowering the value of the dollar, that makes American products less expensive for other nations to buy, and so the goal would be that other nations in the G20 and throughout the world would start buying more American products, and then by doing so, create more jobs. American workers would be making more stuff. Is that right?
Yes, and there's a need for that because the U.S. now has had a trade deficit, which is very large.
Yes,
it just been announced that in September the deficit was a bit lower at $44 billion. two-thirds of that deficit, the American trade deficit, is with China, about $28 billion in 1 month. So if you extrapolate for the entire year, we are talking about $500 billion of trade deficits for the U.S., and nearly two-thirds of that, it's with China. And this is a big problem on both sides. On the side of the United States, why is there such a trade deficit, so a huge trade deficit, and why has China such a large trade surplus? And, of course, this equilibrium in international trade relationships is creating a lot of tension and a lot of economic problem. And the U.S. has to solve somewhat, reduce even further this trade deficit. But sometimes trade deficits are created by fiscal deficits at home. And too much money being printed may increase the deficits in the coming months, in the coming years.
How would, I want to talk more about China, but just in the immediate, how would printing more money worsen the deficit?
Well, it probably won't do work very well for many years, but the reason being that for a while the U.S. dollar may depreciate. But we have seen since the announcement of November the 3rd that the U.S. dollar has begun to strengthen instead of weakening, essentially because long-term interest rates in the U.S. now are on the way up. You know, the 30-year bond, treasury bond is above 4% now. And they, as more inflation expectations enter into the equations of interest rates, then long-term interest rates may go even higher. And this will have two effects. First, it will appreciate the U.S. dollars. And the second may reduce productive investments. So monetary policy is a very dangerous policy if you use it to stimulate an economy, because it may have the reverse effect that what you desire.
Wow. We are talking with Rod Tremblay, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Montreal, about what the heck the Fed is up to. Now, so China, I mean, when parents go to buy Christmas things, virtually all of it, everything is made in China. China, as you say, has a very large trade surplus. Americans are buying stuff from China. So if I have it right, the American consumer now, if the dollar weakens, as it sounds like is intended, American products may be cheaper to buy overseas, and thus the goal may be to stimulate more job creation here in America. But at the same time, the consumer, if the dollar weakens, that makes products we buy from around the world, and we're buying, you know, produce, vegetables, fruit, everything from around the world. Might that not get more expensive?
In theory, yes. Of course, when the dollar falls, foreign prices increase. Unless exporters from China, for example, lower their own prices. You see... China joined the WTO, the World Trade Organization, in 1999 under the Clinton administration. Right. And it's still a communist country politically, but it is a private economy, more and more private economy economically. But it ties its currency mainly to the U.S., plus a basket of other currencies, but mainly to the U.S. So there's no mechanism, easy mechanism, to correct deficits and surplus between the two countries. So there's a stalemate, in a sense, between the United States and China presently. China, of course, enjoys very much its large trade surpluses, because it gives a lot of work to workers in China.
Yeah.
But the U.S., of course, is mired into a trade deficit, and foreign exports of its companies to China and its technology, creating a lot of unemployment in many American cities, and create this very unhealthy political and economic climate. Plus, of course, the housing crisis, which is still going strong, going on strong.
Well, how do you think this will affect employment? The idea of printing more dollars has been tried before. Where has it been tried? How has it worked? And what do you think the actual effect will be on American employment? We're, 10% unemployment now.
Well, when 2 years ago, when the Fed went ahead with the what was called the QE1, the quantitative printing of money in the first round, unemployment was 8.5%, 8.6%. Now it's 9.6%. So unemployment has not declined. And as I mentioned in my blog, the problem with the United States is that there are a lot of structural problems that have to be corrected, beginning with the housing industry, which is still, after 5 years, the top was in 2005, and we are in 2010, and the level of foreclosures is increasing instead of being reduced. And this is having a monkey on the back of the U.S. economy. When there are so many foreclosures, when people lose their jobs, and there's a vicious circle in a certain sense that is playing out with people losing their house, losing their jobs, losing their house, and spending less. And of course, spending less means less production and less and fewer jobs.
Right.
So as long as these structural problems are not tackled head-on, the fear is that the U.S. economy may be like Japan in 1990, in a situation where 10 years of slow growth will be the norm. And this is very unhealthy for young workers, new workers, and people who need the income to survive.
So then if we do not, we in the U.S., if we don't tackle the housing crisis, then that structural problem will just go on. What could we do about the housing crisis? The interest rates are very, very low right now. I would think, not being an economist myself, that having it be easier to borrow money now with low interest rates, that would ease the housing crisis. People would buy more houses and thus create more jobs. But it doesn't.
Well, the housing crisis, just like other structural problems, economic problems in the U.S., is not related that much to interest rates. It's related to the fact that banks have, for many years, stopped being banks, and instead of lending money, have become brokers, selling mortgages to other investors, while the risk is pushed forward to unaware investors. And it's the entire process that is called securitization.
Yes.
Of securities, of mortgages, that should have been stopped. And the financial reform that Congress passed last year didn't address that question at all. Securitization is still going on. And this is very unhealthy because it's very hard to refinance. I'm not talking refinancing in the sense of increasing a loan. It's very hard to lower mortgage costs when there's nobody in charge of a mortgage, and this is the situation today, with the results that it's sort of a legal wheel that crushes people, and the foreclosure machine keeps working, and we know that there are a lot of legal problems connected with that, and people lose their homes maybe unnecessarily. Because the problem has not been tackled head on, and I think the Obama administration is surely partly responsible. Of course, the Bush administration before also, where the problem was created in the first place, was responsible. But my explanation is that many of the economic advisors in the U.S. economy, in the U.S. government, are mainly financiers. They are mainly in the money sectors, and they don't know how the real sector of the economy really functions. If they knew, they would have solved that problem. And it is only one of the structural problems that the U.S. has to solve, but it has not been solved. And as long as the housing crisis is not solved, the U.S. Economic growth will be timid, will be very slow, and very few jobs will be created.
Interesting. It does seem like I can understand the banks, and I guess it would be having to do with the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act from the 1930s.
Oh, yes, 1999.
Well, perhaps you could explain the impact of the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act and how that...
Well, this was a law that was on the books since 1933, mind you. After the crash of 1929, after in the middle of the Great Depression, the government at that time, it was the Roosevelt administration, decided that the banks were not going to create a new financial crisis that can kill the economy. And they passed, and then Congress passed the Glass-Steagall Act. The Glass-Steagall Act made a distinction between commercial banking and investment banking. And commercial banking was done with the private borrowers and mortgage lending and all that. One investment banking, the floating of bonds and stocks for companies was separate.
Yes.
In 1999, with the Republican Congress and the Democratic Clinton administration,
yes,
it was decided that this was not needed anymore. That was very imprudent.
Yes.
Very, very imprudent. Plus the fact that the Greenspan Fed at that time had a policy of printing money as soon as a crisis happened. There was a crisis in the late 1990s in Argentina. There was one also in Asia, in Thailand, and they created what we call the tech bubble, if you remember, that burst in 2000. After the small recession in 2001, then the Greenspan Fed went at it again and created a lot of stimulus, very low interest rate to 1% at that time. It didn't go to zero, it went to 1%, creating the housing bubble. On top of that, the Bush administration passed the tax reduction that is still debated today. That increased the deficit tremendously, the fiscal deficit of the United States tremendously, creating a structural deficit in the U.S., so much so that the Congressional Bureau estimates that if nothing is done by 2020, the fiscal deficit of the United States, the federal government, will be between 6 and 13 trillion dollars during that period, which will be unmanageable.
Yes.
So these two problems are related in a sense. It seems that everybody was contributing in creating that perfect storm, what I call a perfect economic storm that hit the United States.
Wow. So then, given that in 1999, when Glass-Steagall was repealed, since that time, the banks, the lending institutions, have been really focused on the institutional investing, and it's been kind of a bad effect on the average American family worker, because they've been playing basically fast and loose with bundling securities, mixing bad loans with good loans, as we've seen happen, yet they're still doing this securitization. So does this new policy by the Fed that came about on November 3rd, does this benefit those that are already running the banks and make things better for them? Or is it a genuine attempt at stimulating the economy and making things better for working people?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. The type of policy
I was worried about that
announced on November the 3rd, meaning that they stand ready until next spring to buy some $600 billion of securities, they will buy securities from holders. Newly issued securities by the Treasury. Of course, this will be just financing the deficit. But they can buy also securities on the open market, and that will help the banks and other holders of securities. But as I mentioned, the banks are not lacking money these days. They have $1 trillion of dormant reserves that they don't want to use. They don't want to lend to the. They don't want to lend as credit to the small businessmen or to even large corporations because the. They have increased their conditions, the conditions for obtaining loans. And it doesn't help at all the question of securitization at all. The question of securitization is it's just like a financial sausage machine where the banks lend money to borrowers in the form of mortgages, and they take these mortgages, put them in a machine, and mix them with many other mortgages, and come out with a financial sausage mortgage, in a sense. And they slice that sausage, and they sell the slice, financial slice, to other investors. Who carry the risk? The banks are not holding the mortgages that homeowners are paying interest and capital on, but they are only intermediaries in a sense. They are just collecting fees, sort of brokerage fees, between the borrowers and the investors at the other end. This has not been corrected at all, and the November 3rd. Monetary policy announced by the Bernanke Fed is not addressing that question at all.
Wow. Complex, but it affects all of us. Bert Cohen here on The Bert Cohen Show. Our guest today is Rod Tremblay, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Montreal and author of the book The Code for Global Ethics. Well, looking at ethics, so it sounds like that... This new move by the Fed on November 3rd, printing of a lot more money, is it once again helping the people who caused the problem? It's well recognized, I think, by most people that Wall Street and the financial industry created the crash, the Bush crash, and that the Obama administration has surrounded itself in terms of economic advisors with the same people, the Wall Street interests. Are they calling the shots? And is it they who are creating by fiat, basically, without government oversight, since the Fed is an independent board? Are they calling the shots here? And is it going to simply benefit them again? Or again, I guess I kind of asked this before, but I wonder what who has the real power over the economy?
Well, you are right to raise that moral question, which is also a political question. That's why, even if I'm an economist and I've written 30 books, mainly in economics and finance, but my last book is about ethics and morality, and it's called The Code for Global Ethics, in which I talk, there's a chapter on a well-functioning economy should function. But the moral perspective of the thing, the moral side of the thing is that in the mid-1990s, I think, and you remember there was that movie about Wall Street,
yes,
where greed became a goal in itself.
Yeah.
You can do anything to make money, even if you crush a lot of people. And this has created, I think, a moral crisis with many sides, in a sense. Regarding income and wealth distribution, in the U.S. and in other countries also, we are back to where we were in 1928. As far as the inequality between citizens regarding mm-hmm. income and wealth.
Right. It's huge.
In the 1950s and 1960s, the top 1% of the population used to receive about 8 or 9% of income. It was a ratio 1 to 8, 1 to 9.
Uh-huh.
Nowadays, as it was the case in 1928, it's the first 1% receive above 20%, something like 21% of income. In 1928, it was something like 20%. Now we are 21%. So we are back to where we were about 80 years ago. And this is a bad harbinger of things to come, because democracy doesn't function well when the income gap is too wide, as it was in the Latin American countries for many years. And this is one problem. And this is sort of a moral problem also, because too much inequality creates poverty, and the danger in the U.S. in the coming years is the middle class will shrink.
Yes.
And this is very bad for the political health of a society when there's not a very strong middle class. And after the war in 1945, in the 50s and the 60s and even in the 70s, for 30 years, the middle class was prosperous and had hope for the future because income was increasing, education was increasing, and so on. But now we're entering into a period where the middle class is losing their homes, losing their jobs, have trouble with getting their children, and this is very unhealthy. And of course, the election of November 2nd showed mm-hmm. that people are very angry, but they don't know too much how to react to the challenges that they are facing. And this is connected with the fact that the political system in the United States is so much influenced by money. So all these problems are interconnected. And you remember that the Supreme Court decided 5-4 judgment,
yes.
In January,
yes.
last January, decided that companies, banks, could spend as much money as they like during an election. So the individual voters' vote has been devalued in a sense, because your vote is faced with so much propaganda
yes.
that money can buy, that after a while everything is confused and the individual voter doesn't know to what god or what devil to to call for.
So
in that sense,
this new move by the Fed to print $600 billion more money, how does this figure in with that we talked about, you know, the 1% having 21% of the wealth? Who is the Fed? Do they were created, frankly, I'm not sure when, but
1913.
How do they get to do these things? Does this first part of the question, does this printing of $600 billion in new cash benefit the top 1% particularly? And what kind of oversight is there about the Fed? And
well, Mr. Cohen, maybe you should be the first to propose that for the 100th anniversary of the Fed in 1913, to 2013, this uh-huh. is only 3 years from now.
Yes.
You should propose that what J.P. Morgan created in 1913, because the Fed was created by the banks, it was not created by the government, it was created by J.P. Morgan and half a dozen bankers who met in Jekyll Island in Florida, in South Georgia, for a week pretending to go hunting ducks. But they were creating a central bank, and when they came back to Washington, they proposed the new central bank to Congress, and the president, and this was enacted in 1913. So the Fed is the only central bank that I know in the world which is mainly private control.
Hmm.
Wow. You know, there are 12 banking districts in the United States with their own chapters and their own president. And the investors, these banks belong to member banks.
Sure.
And they nominate the president of the local banks, regional banks. There's, of course, the Federal Reserve Board in Washington. And that board is named nominally by the president of the United States, including the chairman of the board. But it's usually done through using a list that the bankers themselves submit to the president.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So in a sense, the bankers are really in charge of the Fed. And they are somewhat in conflict of interest because the Fed is a lender of what we call a last resort,
right,
to the banks. But since the banks are the ones who decide the monetary policy, they can decide to lend money to themselves. And since the Fed is the only bank, being a central bank, that can write a check on itself, creating money in doing so. So the banks are in a position to create money for themselves, in a sense. Not the when they lend money in the normal course of the business cycle, but they can, through the Fed, create money that they are the first to benefit.
Nice, cozy relationship. Isn't that special?
Well, there should be, I think there will be a debate in U.S. Congress as the 100th anniversary of the Fed comes closer, to know what to do about the Fed, because it's a dangerous organization. It has created so many bubbles, financial bubbles, in the past. And from my point of view now, the Bernanke Fed is at it again, as I wrote in my blog. They want to create an asset bubble and a depreciation of the U.S. dollar. But this is so dangerous that you have to be careful. You have to remember that in Germany in the 1920s, when there were a lot of economic problems, they let the central banks create a lot of money, and they ended up with hyperinflation.
Yes.
I don't say that this is going to happen in the U.S., but this is always a fear when you create too much money. And when there's already too much money in the situation as it is now, that you may create an unmanageable inflation in the future that could wipe out the savings of retirees, because we are entering into the baby boomer retirement period now.
Yes.
You know, people who were born in 1946 are retiring, are going to have to be 65 in 2011. And each year there will be a cohort of 5 or 6 million baby boomers retiring. The baby boomers are the ones in the U.S. who were born between 1946 and 1964. And these baby boomers may have problems collecting pensions in the future if there's too much inflation in the system.
Well, I wonder what this new Fed policy might do. And there's still the open question of who's in charge? Who is this Fed? We don't get to have any oversight over them. We, the people, don't have oversight of them. Well, actually, let's deal with that. I mean, the founders of this country, the United States, were very concerned about the idea of a central bank. There was a lot of discussion about a central bank at the founding, at the creation of the Constitution. They had a lot of concerns about it. And if I'm hearing this right, it seems like those concerns that the founders had about giving too much power to a central bank are happening now.
Well, Jefferson, President Jefferson, was very worried about banks. He made so many statesmen worrying about banks. Most presidents during the 19th century were worried about banks. Jackson had fights with banks. President Lincoln had fights with banks. So bankers have always been considered a danger in the society because of that control over the money.
Yeah.
And of course, if you're a farmer, if you're a producer, You always worry that when you borrow money, you won't be able to repay it, and you will go into bankruptcy, and that will be the end of your of your business. And also banks have a lot of influence on governments when governments need to borrow a lot of money. And therefore, the question of money and the way it is created in a system is very important. And that's why a big debate on how the bank, the central bank, should be controlled or made responsible. Of course, now you could say that U.S. Congress committees can interview, testimony from the president of the central bank, but that doesn't influence very much the policy. The policy remains in the hands of the board and on the banks who sit on it.
An unelected, exceedingly powerful group affecting all 305 million Americans and really the entire world.
Well, the irony is that the argument for keeping a central bank independent from the from politics is that it may not be forced to create inflation. The fear will be that if an irresponsible government who run large fiscal deficits, if they finance these deficits with printing money, this will create a lot of inflation and therefore will destroy the currency and bring all types of problems. But nowadays, it's the Fed itself that says that it wants to create inflation. It is afraid that there will be deflation in the economy. Although if you go to the store, you know that there's hardly any deflation around.
Right.
If you look at the price of gold, the price of silver, the price of platinum, they are exploding now.
Yes.
It's more a sign of inflation than of deflation. Therefore, there's an irony here. Central bank, of course, you have to remember that in the charter of the Fed, there are two main objectives, control inflation and stimulate economic growth and employment. In the European Central Bank, they have only the central bank has only one goal: prevent inflation from taking hold, and that's why the central bank in Europe is not behaving the same way as the central bank in the U.S. The central bank in the U.S. has put the interest rates to zero, while in Europe it's still 2%, and in other countries like Australia, interest rates lower, short-term interest rates are 5%. So you see the different approach to monetary policy depending on the objectives that the central bank is given.
And you mentioned the pension funds. This is a great deal of money that working people have in their pension funds. How might this new move by the Fed affect those pension funds and their stability in the near term?
Because you know that there are two types of pension funds. There are defined benefit pension funds, which is a type which is declining because many companies don't like to have the responsibility of having defined benefits, because if an employee is entitled to receive a pension, the company has to finance it. And we know that General Motors and Ford and Chrysler had tremendous pension liabilities of that sort. When you lower interest rates very much, as it is the case for the last two or three years, I mean, close to zero, or even if it is 1% or 2%, this increases the liabilities of defined benefit pension plans, because the income that the pension plan receives from its investments tend to be lower.
Sure.
And if interest rates were kept to the floor, as they have been kept it to the floor in Japan, this will create problems to finance the pensions of defined pension plans in the future. Of course, the other type of pension plans are the contributory pension plans, where the employees invest in 401ks and other instruments, and the companies is not responsible. A company can contribute to the pension plan, the private pension plan of the employee, but the company is not responsible for paying a given pension to the employee. Therefore, the employee carries the risk that its plan won't be big enough to sustain an income flow high enough when he or she retires.
Right. And there's a lot of us going to do that.
That may be a problem now with so low interest rates, because the baby boomers were counting on a small nest of savings when interest rates were 6, 7, 8%. Now, when they are down to 2% or 1%, of course, the flow of income from a given pool of savings is much lower. Sure. You know, at 1% interest rate, $1 million gives you only $10,000. Of course, with Social Security and other source of income, you may go by, but that's not the type of income that you may have envisage.
That is for sure. Again, Bert Cohen here on The Bert Cohen Show. We're talking with Rod Tremblay, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Montreal, who has a good vantage point on the U.S. economy. So you are concerned about what the Fed is doing, that there may be some unintended, perhaps adverse consequences. Perhaps it might make matters worse. If you can see this, why can't the Fed see this, and why can't President Obama see this?
Well, there are many reasons. First of all, I don't think President Obama has any training in economics that I know of.
Good point.
His training is more in law, and constitutional law, if I understand.
Yes.
And if you don't have a training in economics, you are subjected to the pressure or the arguments that are brought to you. And when he got into power, he's surrounded with many economists who were with the Clinton administration.
Right.
And they were of the deregulation thesis, like Larry Summers and other economists of that ideology. And in the sense, therefore, he didn't come into the government with a new idea of changing economic policies. He wanted to continue what had been going on since the Clinton administration. And I mentioned the Glass-Steagall Act was removed with the signature of President Clinton, even if the Congress, Senator Graham from Texas, for example, was one of the sponsor of the abolishment of the Glass-Steagall Act, was a Republican, but the president was a Democrat. So I think President Obama didn't have a grasp of economics enough to have a big picture of what to do and what not to do. So when they came out to him and say, we have to save the banks, he could have said, well, we have to save the economy. We don't have to save the banks. We want to save the economy. We want to save homeowners, at least the responsible homeowners among them, from going to bankruptcy. If there are banks who go into bankruptcy, well, they will lose their job. And we are not going to put trillions of money in the banks while the rest of the economy languishes. And that was a big mistake, and he's paying a big political price for that, because he gave the impression that you can give $2 or $3 trillion to the banks and the bankers, who kept paying themselves huge bonuses, and let the rest of the economy find its equilibrium, and it's not a good equilibrium. 9.6% in unemployment. Well, the real unemployment is closer to 17% because the permanent unemployment and the top part-time
underemployed
employment is not counted in the 9.6% rate, official rate. So that's the main reason. The other reason, of course, is that the U.S. Government now is in a gridlock. it was partly in a gridlock even when it was a Democratic majority, because within the Democratic Party, there are many factions. There were the Blue Dogs,
yes,
and all that, and it was very hard to move with bold initiatives. And the Republicans on their sides thought that it was to their advantage to stall things down. And that is very worrying for the next 2 years, because, as I mentioned in my blog, the Fed is the only way, only institution that can move quickly, while the rest of the government will be bickering and arguing and going nowhere. There was the first part of the report of the Fiscal Responsibility Panel yesterday, proposing a long list of measures to correct the fiscal structural problem. But already, senators and congressmen will pick up good little bits that they like, and they will drop the other part. And that they may make things worse if they increase spending without increasing revenues. So these are the two reasons I think that you have the feeling there's nobody in charge. There's no captain in the ship. Hmm. It's just like that cruise ship that is being on the
Pacific, yes,
on the shores of Mexico and California. There's no engine.
Oh my goodness!
Maybe there's no brain either.
Maybe not. Well, you have also, I just want to touch on one other phrase you use, the imperial dollar. What does that mean, the imperial dollar, and how was the average American affected by that?
Well, after the war in 1944, there was the Bretton Woods Conference in New Hampshire, by the way.
Yes.
And where it was decided to accept John Maynard Keynes, the British economist's plan, it was Keynes proposed, but it was Secretary White plan, which was really adopted at the end, of having a key currency like the U.S. dollar, which was the strongest economy after the war. I mean, Great Britain had been destroyed, so the British pound could not play that role, and gold was not in sufficient amount to guarantee the growing economy. So they used the gold exchange standard, where the U.S. dollar was converted into gold for a while, and all the other central banks will peg their currencies to gold and to the dollar.
Yes.
And this lasted until September 15, 1971, when the U.S. decided that their gold stock in Fort Knox was not big enough to sustain the demand for gold all around the world. And then we went on the dollar system. And that's where we have been since. And as I mentioned, many countries tied their currencies to the dollar. And especially China tied the yuan, their local currency, their national currencies to the dollar. And we have a lot of flexibility among convertible currencies like the Canadian dollar, the euro, and others. But some other currencies are not very convertible. They are not very flexible. Therefore, that mechanism now is breaking down. It doesn't correct the imbalances that we have in trade flows. Some countries have too large deficits, like the U.S. Some other countries, like China, have too large surpluses. And this is very unhealthy. It has to be corrected. So therefore, I mentioned that maybe there will be a reform of the Federal Reserve System when it gets to be 100 year old. But now with the dollar system, which has been enforced since 1944, I think we are in need now of a new reform of the international monetary system. And we don't know who is going to take the initiative to try to propose changes. Everybody thinks that the system doesn't work properly, but there's no firm proposal on the table to move from a different system. So we are stuck with the U.S. dollar as being the world currency at the same time that the U.S. central bank, the Fed, doesn't think it is in its responsibility to provide liquidity to the rest of the world or provide an international currency.
Yeah.
The Fed considered that the dollar is mainly an American currency, which is legitimate, but that leaves a void in the international system. And if it is not corrected, then we may go back to capital controls, maybe protectionism in the coming years, and the entire move towards globalization of the economy may unravel in the future if nothing is done, and that would be the responsibility of the G20 countries in Seoul to try to avoid that and to come up with concrete proposals and don't leave things rot and become unmanageable.
Wow. My goodness, this has been exceedingly informative, if not uplifting. If people want to find out more about your analysis of the economy, I presume there's something on the internet to which you can direct them.
Yeah, I have my blog, of course. That blog is in 10 languages, and it is read all over the world, in India, in Pakistan, in Europe, in China. Just go to www.thenewamericanempire.com/blog. thenewamericanempire.com/blog. And this is the same for my most recent book, The Code for Global Ethics, www.thecodeforglobalethics.com. It's on Amazon and on Barnes & Noble and many places. In that book, I talk not only about ethics, but I talk about economics and finance also. There's a chapter about the good functioning of an economic system and a monetary system.
Well, perhaps we can learn and improve things. Professor Tremblay, thank you so much for being with us on the Bert Cohen Show. Very informative. Thanks a lot.
It was very interesting. Thank you very much, Mr. Cohen. Good luck.
Good luck to us all. Thank you very much. And as always, I look forward to your input. Email me, Bert, B-U-R-T, at thebertcohenshow.com. Thanks again for listening.
Money. Money. Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world go round. Money makes the world go round, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound, a buck or a pound, a buck or a pound is all that makes the world go round. The clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, money, money. Money, 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 money. If you happen to be rich and you feel like a night's entertainment, you can pay for a gay escapade. If you happen to be rich and alone and you need a companion, it's a ring for the maid. If you happen to be rich and you find you are left by your lover and you moan and you groan right a lot, you can take it on a train, call a cab, and begin to recover on your 14-carat yacht.
What?
Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world go round. Money makes the go round, of that we both are sure. I'm being poor. Money, 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 money. When you haven't any shoes and your feet and your coats that is paper and your look that
you
can't
get away.
When you go to get a word of advice from the fat little pastor, he will tell you the love of a maw. But when hunger comes a rap at the window. At the window.
Who's there?
Hunger.
Oh, hunger.
See how love flies out the door. Money makes the world go round and well, go round and well. Money makes the world go round, the clinking, clanking sound of money, 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 give a little, get a little, money, 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 back again, the buck or